welcome to Transcending Comics, a podcast dedicated to trans representation in comic books, manga, and webtoons, both on panel and behind the scenes. I'm your host, Tommy, and today I'm joined by Nikki Smith and Ollie Hicks, two incredible creators calling in from across the sea for the show's first ever double interview. Nikki Smith has contributed a wide variety of talents to the comics industry, from writing and drawing her own young adult graphic novels like The Deep and Dark Blue and Golden Hours, to spicy erotic comics like Bruised Fruit and Crossplay, and even making artistic contributions to the Adventure Zone comics and The Witch Boy. Ollie Hicks has also contributed to comics of all shapes and sizes, from short comics to webcomics, zines, and graphic novels, with notable books like the widely praised Grand Slam Romance, to funny and sexy comics like Butch Bros and Henchmen Stay Off. Their work is equal parts relatable and absurd in all the best ways possible. These two incredible talents are working alongside co-editor Tab Kimpton to bring together an incredible collection of sexy comics, Succulent, a trans-inclusive sapphic comics anthology, which has an ongoing Kickstarter campaign at the time of this episode's release. Here to discuss their contributions to the book are today's guests, Nikki and Ollie. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hello.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about how the two of you came together for this project. This is your first time collaborating together, right?
Yeah. Well, I think Nikki and Tab had already sort of started cooking the project anthology. And then, yeah, so y'all started together on the anthology first. I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I've known Tab for years. I've known Tab's comics, especially for years. They were some of the first web comics I read when I was a tiny queer teen looking for queer web comics in the very early 2000s. And recently, Tab started doing a series of erotic comic anthologies, starting with Come Together, which is all European comic creators after Brexit and about coming together, you know, sexily. And after that, he followed up with Ambrosia and Nectar and Nether Realms. And those are all various queer, trans, non-binary titles, erotic comics. And he wanted to follow that up with a sapphic anthology. And he got in touch with me and then brought Ollie on board to be our third co-editor.
Very nice. And I've noticed that this book has a good 19 different contributors all working on 12 different stories. So I'm curious how you went about finding and choosing contributors to this book and what that process looks like.
You want to handle that?
Okay. So basically, we put out a call for contributors. So we came together, we discussed what we thought the book sort of remit was. We sort of wrote some copy, sort of envisioning different ways the theme could be reinterpreted. And then we sort of put it out and sort of saw what sort of stories people sort of contributed in terms of ideas. So we initially got, I think it was almost 100 people submitted ideas. And we had a huge all-day meeting where we went through and sort of thought which stories we were sort of really felt we were like a different take on the theme, which sort of creators we were like, we have to work with them, like they're going to bring something really unique. And so from that, we sort of slowly whittled it down to the 12 stories that we have in the anthology.
Yeah, and Tab done something unique where he likes to give writers and artists the chance to apply separately and get paired up to work on the anthology. Because it can be a lot, like a really big hurdle for unknown writers to come prepared with an artist already on board. So we got some really fun writer-only pitches, and then we gave, you know, them a bunch of artist options that we really thought fit the story well, and they, you know, found someone they really wanted to work with, and that was its own extra fun process.
Tell us a bit about the two comics that you're both contributing. This time, let's start with you, Nikki.
My comic is called Prickly Pear. It is a Am I Allowed to Curse?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The hate fuck. in the middle of the desert, there are bruises and biting and lots of smirking butches getting sweaty and accidentally catching prickly pears with their bare hands.
Now, Ollie, tell us a little bit about The Plant Sitter.
Okay, so my one's also about like butch idiots. So my one is about a sort of horny plant sitter who gets the opportunity to look after a silver fox dyke daddy's plant collection. Unfortunately, they overwater the daddy's like sort of prized sentient cactus, and they have to sort of go to a slightly extreme length in order to bring the cactus back from the brink.
You've mentioned the dumb butches as a common theme in both of your comics, and Ollie, I've noticed that you especially managed to inject your own personal brand of humor into the mix with delightful results, even in your sexy stories. So will this same sense of humor then be on display in The Plant Sitter?
Oh, yeah. No, that's not a serious story at all. It's really silly. I'm very much like, I guess I come from comedy. It's sort of like where I started writing. And so I always feel more confident and comfortable in comedy anyway. Yeah, that was the one comic that when I was reading through, sometimes I'd be like, this one's wild. Who wrote this? And I'd be like, oh, no, wait, that was me.
Now, if this one's too personal, I can edit this out later. No worries. But I wanted to ask, like, in your own life, do you have any thoughts on the role humor plays within intimacy, especially as a comedian? Like, I'm curious how that influences the way you write stories like this.
Yeah, I'm so silly all the time. Yeah, I don't want to get too much into it because my wife will be like, you can't put us on blast like this in on a podcast. But I am silly. And like, I feel like some people take sex very seriously and I'm just a silly goofball clown. And ladies, that applies to all areas. Trying to think of a cool way I can say this without like being too much of a clown on main. But yeah, no, I feel like there's a playfulness in queer identity, especially that I feel like is actually very undervalued and little understood in heteronormative society. And I feel that extends to things like sexual expression. And I feel like a lot of the times people maybe take sex quite seriously, not to completely pit us against the head, but like I feel like there's this seriousness around sex sometimes when sex is silly and goofy, and sometimes it can be like, you know, amazing and sad and tragic, and like there's all these different things that sort of happen in sex. But one of the things that happens is that sex can be really silly and can be really funny, and that's like part of, for me, one of the joys of sex is it can be a funny time.
Now, Nikki, I've noticed that with your comics, you often play with a color palette that's heavily influenced by one color, most notably in indigo and in the deep and dark blue. So will you be using a similar color effect in Prickly Pear, or will this be a new kind of art style?
I absolutely do, but that's because the entire anthology has a limited color palette. The whole book is colored with the various tones from the lesbian flag. So for my comic, I stuck to the sunset side, so the reds and yellows and oranges, as opposed to the pinks and violets, which is supposed to sort of stand for the butcher side of the lesbian spectrum. So very fitting because it takes place in a desert under the hot, blazing sun. But I had a lot of fun coloring it and not trying to stick with, you know, natural lighting or anything like that. So it really takes on some more extreme coloring, I think.
Now, one of the most distinct things I've noticed about your art style is the way you draw characters blushing by like using the red lines across the face. And I found this to be used like really effectively through your comics, and I think it makes your characters just seem really visually endearing. And I'm curious about how this artistic signature of yours came about.
I'm sure it's the very basic root of it is just that I grew up reading a lot of manga. And there's a lot of blushing in manga. And then, yeah, at some point, I really like working with limited palettes and bringing in spot colors like that. And warm blushes, I think, really sort of stand out a lot in pop. So I have fun with that.
Yeah, I especially noticed it in Crossplay and 11/11 Days, I think, is maybe my favorite use I've seen of this in your work.
Thank you.
Now, question for you both. I've noticed that both of you have a bit of a history of taking your short stories or short comics and getting the chance to turn them into full-length graphic novels. Ollie, I know that you and Emma Oosterhaus had a particularly wild journey in turning your 17-page zine for a Grand Slam romance into a now graphic novel series. So can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how that opportunity came to be?
Yeah, that was the wildest experience of my life. So I was at Thought Bubble, which is a UK comic convention. I wasn't supposed to be there. Basically, two guys I knew, David Robertson and Joan Edam, they were tabling at the con, and Joan had to drop it out because his partner was having a baby. So David was like, do you want to be my table mate? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll show up. So I wasn't like on the list, on the map or anything like that. I was just sort of hanging out. And Emma had some Shiva prints. So I like threw them up on the table because I'm a good sort of partner, and was like, yeah, here's my girlfriend's prints. And yeah, this woman came over, looked at the She-Ra prints, and then saw Grand Slam Romance. And was sort of talking to me, asking me a couple questions about it. And I was like, yeah, sure. And she was like, I've got like an imprint in the States. I was like, okay, cool. Like, sure you do. And then like, she was like, yeah, like, maybe I'll talk to you about it. I was like, yeah, cool. And then like, then a couple of hours later, Emma texted me and goes, why has Mariko Tamaki just followed me on Twitter? What have you done? Who have you talked to? What have you done? And I was like, oh, what? Because like comics, I feel like it's one where you never know what people look like as an industry. I don't know what anybody looks like unless I meet them in person. So I was just, at one point I asked her where she was tabling. It's so embarrassing. Like, because you're like, oh, you seem cool. Where are you tabling? She's like, nah, I don't have a table. I was like, okay, weird. All right, each to their own. And so from that initial Twitter interchange, Mariko asked us to pitch the book. So we sort of had this crazy 2-week sort of stretch where we sort of threw together a pitch document, not knowing anything. And then like sort of eventually out of that, a graphic novel deal got on the table and we were able to sort of make it.
Now, Nikki, in a similar way, I've seen that your short comic Indigo from Love in All Forms clearly seems to share a similar visual style and similar themes with the book you would later develop with The Deep and Dark Blue. Could you tell us a bit about how you went about reworking just a 6-page silent comic into a full-length fantasy graphic novel?
I've done a lot of anthologies sort of over the years, and I always have fun sort of working with either a themed anthology or, you know, just a limited number of pages. And that sort of restriction helps me come up with a lot of like ideas and push me in different directions. So I really enjoyed this idea behind the short comic Indigo, which is all about this vivid blue dye and a young trans girl who sort of yearns to be part of the world of the women who are working with it. And then a few years later, middle grade graphic novels were starting to become more openly queer, and that was like beginning to be acceptable to pitch to publishers, especially with Witch Boy by Molly Ostertag, which has a gender nonconforming kid as the main character. And I decided to go ahead and like try and do a pitch myself for a full length book. And so I developed The Deep and Dark Blue sort of with that same basic idea of the dye as the heart of it, but then went in a completely different fantasy direction and turned it into something totally different. But my original pitch for the book was also this limited grayscale color palette with a spot blue, but my publisher really wanted a full color book. But even in the finished book, I tried to only use blue when the twins are in like dealing with magic. The source of the magic is this blue dye. So even then, in this full color book, I'd still worked in my limited palette.
Now, on The Deep and Dark Blue, I couldn't help but notice a number of parallels between its premise and the plot of the movie Some Like It Hot. My girlfriend just showed me that this year, so it's been kind of at the forefront of my mind. So I'm curious if this was like an intentional reworking of that story and its tropes, or is that just a complete coincidence?
I don't think I've ever seen that. Can you tell me what it's about?
So yeah, Some Like It Hot is like an old film with Marilyn Monroe, and it features two guys that are also like being pursued by nefarious characters. Yeah. And similarly, like one of them, when they integrate into this group of female performers, like one's clearly taking to it more than the other and like gets to feel themselves. And like, even when I read the summary of The Deep and Dark Blue, I'm like, oh my gosh, is this Some Like It Hot? That's awesome. I need to check this one out. So that's why I had my eyes on this.
In there. Yeah, really deep down. I saw that with one of my best friends when I was a teenager, who later came out as trans as well. And so maybe it was very deep in my subconscious as an idea. Yeah. But yeah, I really wanted the twins in The Deep and Dark Blue to have that clear sign for readers. Like, one of these kids is definitely trans. Like, this is not a, you know, going back to being cis and happy and straight at the end sort of story, like all the books that I grew up reading about gender adventures as a kid were. I really wanted to show that parallel. Grace is incredibly happy where she is, while her brother is not. It's a very different experience for them both.
With these, like, having now both had the experience of getting to adapt your previous work into longer, later works and graphic novels, is there any particular short comics of yours, or especially in like your erotic work in various anthologies, that you ever want to revisit and maybe try and remake into a longer story?
Oh, wait.
Ooh, I mean, generally I try and be like, when it's done, it's done. But there's one I'm like working on right now, which is like a 60 pager, but I'm like, I want this to be a full length graphic novel. But I'm like, stop it, just do the 60 pages and get it out. I'm working on a comic about Christian teens who are very gay and at a festival. And it's sort of like, I was like, there's lots of Christian trauma comics, but where's the funny Christian trauma comic? I was like, it's not funny being horny and gay and Christian. So I'm sort of exercising my teenage demons with that one. It's 60 pages at the moment, but I'm like, oh, I want this to be a full-length graphic novel. So yeah.
When you say festival, is this like a music festival scenario?
Oh no, it's a Christian festival, because you have Christian summer festivals. It's like the worst.
Okay. Not I had church too camp hard,
but like it's the worst.
Is this a British thing?
Maybe this is just a British thing. We used to like go on summer, like they all had names like Summer Madness and Autumn Soul, and like you would go and like just camp in a tent, and there'd be like a big Christian speaker or something, and you'd have worship bands, and then there'd be like little bits. There was this one that's just like really, it was called like, you'd have like little sort of pop-up shacks and stuff, and one was called the Love Shack, and it was like actually like a stealth abstinence shack, and that was the worst experience. I was like, no, caught. So yeah, just doing a comic about that.
I was curious because like I've heard stories at the music festivals I frequent that if people invite you onto their bus for a sandwich and a cookie, don't go, because it's some weird Christian offshoot cult that's like taking people back and putting them into sandwich work, or like making them work for some kind of Christian sandwich shop. And I can't believe it's real, but multiple people have shared this story.
That's terrible. What also, like, the sandwich and the cookie is such a suspicious setup though. Especially because it actually is like a sandwich for sandwich servitude, like.
Yeah, I feel like I just need to do my part and let any other festival goers out there to know, like, be wary of bus sandwiches and cookies. Stay safe out there. Don't.
I think even if they're not Christian, don't take anybody up on a sandwich and a cookie in a bus deal. Like, that just is the most, like, just don't go onto buses with people you don't know and accept food from them.
Moving this back to Nikki, as far as your other, like, anthology work and short comics, is there anything else you'd love to rework and expand into, like, a longer comic, graphic novel, anything like that?
Right now, I don't think so. My graphic novel Crossplay, which is also erotica that you mentioned, did also start as shorter, smutty comics. And I pitched a few of my comics to Spike at Iron Circus Comics. And she was like, why don't we turn Crossplay into a full book? And so we did. And that one is about a group of friends at a anime convention, basically figuring out sexuality and feelings and gender and all those things through fandom. So, you know, wearing their first wig or their first binder, or, you know, trying on different pronouns for the day, and just a supportive environment, but also sexy times.
Now, in writing Crossplay, were you drawing from like any kind of lived experience as a cosplayer, or like things you observed at conventions? I just felt, from my limited experience, this felt like a very real convention experience put to comic form.
I definitely went to a lot of conventions growing up, but I was more the quiet artist and not the like 3D stuff and art and clothes and all that are beyond me completely. But I have so many friends who, you know, did self-expression through cosplay, and I really wanted to draw that sort of love for fandom. But I will never draw a comic set at a convention ever again, because that was
out. Do either of you at least have a go-to costume for like parties, conventions, or other costumed events?
No, not anymore. Gave it up because I was so bad, nobody knew who I was. The last one I did was Super Horse.
Like Supergirl's horse?
Yeah, Supergirl's pet horse, who's a boyfriend. And he turns into a cowboy. Yeah, classic. He's one of my favorite things that's ever happened in comics. So it went as Super Horse, and like one old man was just like, are you Super Horse? But everyone else was just like, I don't know what's going on.
What did your costume look like, though?
It looked like a mess because I can't sew. It was just like a horse hat. I think it was a cape, maybe.
So you didn't get a second person behind you in the classic two-person horse costume?
No, maybe...
couples costume.
Like, maybe next couples cosplay, Super Horse and Supergirl. Like, I don't think I could convince Emma to do that.
But if there's a lasso involved?
I think it could be fun, but I feel like also, again, so niche that everyone just be like, what is happening?
Now, I've noticed that both of you do a good job subtly introducing fantasy elements in otherwise grounded stories in your work. Ollie, I especially liked the way that you introduced elements of, like, magical girl stories into a sports graphic novel with Grand Slam Romance. So could you tell us a bit about how you decided what elements of magical girl anime and comics you'd bring into this work and, like, how you would make this fit in a world with otherwise human characters?
Yeah, so basically the way Grand Slam Romance came about was that me and Emma were like, wanted to do a comic together because we both did comics separately and we're like, we should do something together. So Emma wanted to do a magical girl comic and I wanted to do sports. So that's the first thing, is that Emma's the magical girl fan, but I'm the person who writes the scripts. So like, I think, so basically we sort of, I don't remember what research or world building we sort of decide, because it was originally just 19 pages, we were just like, and then this will happen and that'll be funny. And then we sort of had to expand it for one graphic novel. So we were like, okay, so this is sort of the rules. And then we had to do another two graphic novels. And we're like, oh no, we really, the world building, we should have plotted this all out from the beginning. So the way it sort of, I guess the way it sort of came together was, I guess the system was just kind of like, what is the most overpowered way you can do something for the lowest actual real life stakes? And that was sort of the rules. Was so originally, like in the 19 page one, it was like, softball was a bit more like you could get 600,000 million runs or something like that. And it was a bit more all OP'd. And then what sort of happened in the graphic novel was that it sort of then sort of shifted where it's like you could have these gigantic sort of Bleach style explosive sort of displays, but it had to be for something very low stakes. Like mostly they just use their powers for sex, I would say, but like to score one run in softball. So I guess it was just sort of like, it's mostly informed, I think, by comedy or what the plot has to, or where the plot has to go.
In a similar vein, the Deep and Dark Blue, I noticed, makes selective and kind of deliberate use of the few occasions that magic is used through the book. Nikki, could you tell us like how you decided how far you wanted to go into the realm of fantasy in that story and world?
Sure. So the Deep and Dark Blue, the source of magic is this blue dye. And the way it's implemented or used is through weaving or spinning or fiber arts, pretty much. Because I want it to sort of centered around, quote unquote, women's work. And that this world that Grace wanted to be part of, but also for, you know, secret other reasons that she yearned to be part of this world. And so I don't really love info dumping in stories. So I wanted to keep it pretty vague. Aside from that, there's, I think, seven different sort of aspects to this, the Communion of Blue, this order of women who work the fiber arts. There's healing and spinning and weaving and the people who look after the herds for the wool and also the dyers creating the dye and all of this stuff. And I left it open enough that if, you know, sequels ever happen, I can explore more of that in those, but I didn't want to like make myself try to explain everything in detail in the book itself. That it's there for the story, and the rest the reader can expand upon as imagination wants to.
Are there currently any set plans for a sequel for the book, or is that kind of back burner ideas at the moment?
Back burner ideas right now. I did have a pitch a couple years ago, I think in 2019, I pitched a sequel, like right as this one was coming out, but the publisher decided to go with The Golden Hour instead because they wanted to see how The Deep and Dark Blue worked, and then I got busy with other projects. But I'm very glad that did not work out, because I would have spent 2020 working on a book about a illness epidemic, and I feel like I sort of escaped that by the skin of my teeth.
On the use of trans characters in your work, Ollie, I have to say, I really love the way that you introduced the concept of a trans mask magical girl in Grand Slam Romance. Could you tell us about like how you went about the design process for the character of Wolfgang and like their development as a character throughout the story?
Oh, yeah. Well, Wolfgang is just a butch lesbian, so I don't sort of read Wolfgang as a trans math character. I think it's out of my hands. If people want to interpret her that way, they can. But we always sort of just were just like, Wolfgang's a butch lesbian was how we sort of envisioned her. But if you want, do you want me to still talk about Wolfgang or not?
Yeah, I mean, I still love the character's design. Like, it's very non-traditional from what I've seen elsewhere with magical girls. Like, honestly, the whole short top, like, I think I may have thought that was a binder at first impressions. I'm like, oh, that's kind of badass.
Okay. So, I mean, like, this is, this is a butch lesbian. And it is the character that most people are like, oh, like, do be like, okay, but like genderqueer in some way. And we were like, oh, we've always just seen her as a butch lesbian. But like, I honestly don't care how people want to read Wolfgang. I think it's all fine. And so basically, the design of Wolfgang is all from the side of things. So the way me and Emma collaborate is like extremely sort of close on story stuff. And then I sort of go do the script. She kind of goes in the way, there's like 1,000 different designs of the characters. And she was very much wanted every character in Grand Slam to have like their own iconography. So Mickey has a heart, Astra has a star, Wolfgang, she wanted to have a diamond. And then she sort of brought in elements of like, she kind of, because Wolfgang is like a clubber, so she kind of wanted to bring in elements of sort of like leather and sort of like hard, sort of like almost going into the fetish community, sort of like with the harnesses and stuff like that, kind of wear. And then she also wanted to have sort of neons for all of that. So she kind of wanted Wolfgang to be like quite like sort of a hard aesthetic character, because I think Wolfgang puts on like a very hard front, but is also quite a little goofball. And then that's sort of like how we developed Wolfgang. And then in book two, we do have a trans mass magical character, Rock, which basically what's happened is I will be like, what's the coolest guy I can think of that I really want to be? And then Emma will be like, is it this? I'm like, yes. So I think it's kind of probably more of that in book two, but like, yeah, that's how we came up with Wolfgang. I was just like, who's the coolest dude I can think of? I was like, it's Wolfgang.
Now, Nikki, as for trans rep in your comics, I've really thought you've done an incredible job with your portrayal of trans characters in the Deep and Dark Blue and Crossplay, and incorporating trans and genderqueer characters of all kinds in Bruised Fruit. And I'd love to know how you go about respectfully and faithfully portraying queer and trans experiences outside of your own lived experiences in your books.
I always work really closely with just close friends and family members of mine. And I also work with just authenticity readers who I don't know personally, who can bring their own completely separate perspective to my stories, just to make sure that I'm not stepping on any toes or doing anything stupid without thinking. And they've been really wonderful to work with. I worked with May Rood, journalist and writer for, I think she works for them right now, I'm not sure about that, where she's currently at, but on the Deep and Dark Blue, and she was an enormous help. And I would work with her again in a heartbeat if I get to do sequels ever. But working with other people, authenticity readers, is a huge help for sure.
Back to Ollie with Grand Slam Romance. I think maybe my favorite thing about the book was that I didn't think it really fit any of the two or three typical narratives that I see in every sports film that seems to come out. And its structure is really unlike any sports story I've seen elsewhere. Could you tell us about how you went about telling a sports story that seems to break this mold so much?
Yeah, well, starting off, I never played sports as a kid. And my interest in doing a sports story was purely from sports fanfic AUs. So I came to this purely from a thirst angle, where I was like, the uniforms are hot. And then like Emma had to sit me down and be like, okay, this is a softball game. This is how it works. And I was like, oh, this is really complicated. And then like once she bought me like a softball as a present, I was like, this is huge. Just like, you've got to learn more about softball. So I do actually have like, I do read softball books. I read multiple books in the world. But anyway, the way you sort of structured it is, I guess the reason it doesn't play out like a sports story is because the way it's actually, I kind of structure it in my head, is it's a character drama. So it probably plays out more like a traditional romance. It's more focused on like on how the characters sort of interact with each other. And the sports is sort of like, oh, okay. So the way it works is, did you ever read like Steve Neill's work on the musical, which is also used a lot in porn studies?
No.
Okay, so the musical genre basically is like the way music is introduced is in like this explosion of singing and dancing. And it's the way, so the, it's like when they're like the emotions are at their most high, that's when you have singing and dancing. And there's like a really influential paper I read once when I was a student that like in porn, the sex happens like in a musical where the emotions are high. And I'm a musical fan. So the way I think of things, it's like a musical. So it's sort of like, I use it to sort of structure, yeah, for like moments of huge emotion.
That is not at all the answer I expected, but I can definitely see some of that at play. Like, I mean, the inversion of the antagonist as like an underdog halfway through, I think kind of
that's
fits that.
That's because of Archie. I love Archie comics, and I'm a Veronica fan, and I think Veronica's the underdog, and that's why Grand Slam is structured the way it is, because I'm like, what if the Veronica character gets everything that they want and deserve?
And that's been a pretty big inspiration for you throughout your comics, right, with Archie comics. So I'd love to hear a bit about how that's played out throughout your career.
I think the way I feel about Archie is like, it's really classic sort of love triangle, like one of like the most classic 20th century love triangles. And also Archie comics is, I was thinking about what one of my greatest comics of all time would be the other day. And I was like, it should be Archie comics, because like, you know, when you read those lists, they're always like, oh, Love and Rockets. I'm like, Love and Rockets wouldn't be there without Archie comics. Archie is like, just, I don't know how to describe why I love Archie comics the way I do. I just feel like there's something very iconic about the characters, the way they sort of just endlessly reset, the way they sort of move through time, but don't move through time. But also because it's like this sort of camp piece of Americana. It's like, in many ways, like I think like is as a British person who sort of accesses America through Hollywood and now through my American wife, like Archie is like a very classic form of Americana. And like even to this age, like when you get the old Archie comics, because I have like a little bit of a collection of old Archie comics, and you get sort of the frayed pages, you also have the Dan DiCarlo art, which is like so iconic. It's like the way Dan DiCarlo draws and inks things was like really influential to me for a while. And I don't know, I think like in many ways the characters are so empty and they mean nothing, so they mean everything, and they're so full and they reset all the time, they're constantly contradictory, so you can read anything you want into the characters. So, and it's like all about sort of like this classic view of the suburbs, which isn't ever true. And I'm off on, sorry, you're like sports, magical girls. I'm like, actually, Archie is musical. Like, what are my nerd topics are? I don't really know how to explain why. I think it's just something I got really obsessed with, especially with Riverdale, because I was already into Archie, but then Riverdale was just like, yes. I loved it so much because complete garbage, and I love garbage. And I think it just sort of was a time when I was doing my PhD in like classic American comics. So it was just something that I was reading a lot of. And so that sort of like just ended up influencing a lot of my work.
By all means, feel free to gush about Archie and musicals as much as you want on here. I think for a podcast that has as much queer subject matter as mine does, surprisingly, I don't think we've touched on either of those topics at all in my like 20 episodes now. So thank you for bringing that much needed representation to the podcast, Holly.
Thank you.
Now, Nikki, I'm curious about your artistic work as well, and like what's been the major inspirations for you in your art style as it's developed over the years?
Oh, gosh. Going back to those roots again, the manga, the way early webcomics, Artists on Live Journal that I found back in the day, just seeing indie artists growing up together on the internet and like supporting each other and sort of their styles feeding each other and bouncing back and forth, I think was always a really big inspiration for me. And I would, you know, try and mimic the Photoshop coloring styles that they did in my own work and sort of find my feet doing coloring that way. Because for a long time, I would try and stick with like black and white comics because I didn't feel confident doing color, or I would do the limited palette where I would just have the one spot color in there and sort of getting a lot of inspiration everywhere. I love Jillian Tamaki and Mariko Tamaki. Yeah, just a whole lot of queer comics. I read a ton of Yuri, especially growing up. So lesbian manga.
Now, I know that you've played a pretty wide role as far as like what kind of contributions you've made to comics, like from either like both writing and drawing them yourself to like contributing flat artwork or inking. And I'm curious, like, about how you feel. Like, do you prefer to take the reins of the story and, like, do it all yourself? Or do you kind of like to just only have to worry about the artwork on some of your other books?
I definitely prefer to do my own stories, like, 100% writing them, drawing them, and I'm also doing colors. So if it's my own story, I want to be just, if at all possible, doing my own thing whenever I can get the chance. But comics doesn't pay particularly well. So a lot of the times you fill in the gaps between books with, say, flatting jobs on other books or inking jobs for friends and things like that. So I've sort of done a little bit of everything, I guess, at this point. I started editing some comics for Filthy Figments, which is an erotic comics web collective. It's a subscription site. That's where I got my start really making comics. Did like 600 at least pages in their archives over 10 years, something like that. That's where Crossplay originally serialized before it came out as a book. And even after I stopped having time to draw new comics for them, I would help out by editing sort of as they brought on new artists. And then getting the chance to work with Tab on this one was really fun too, and work with Ollie. Mm-hmm. I had a blast. Like, it was probably the smoothest collaboration I've ever had. We would meet up just video or voice calls regularly, working through, you know, all the work on the book that we had to check off and figuring out the artists. And it was a ton of fun just as the pages came in.
Now, when it comes to a book like Succulent that had hundreds of submissions for stories, did you have any kind of system for how you went through these and like how you decided which ones would make it into the list, or like even how to narrow down such a large submission size?
Yeah, I think we just had a very basic sort of rating system where we would just sort of, we'd rate the story ideas, we'd rate the art ideas, and then we'd sort of like, it would, because there were so many people, it was like, if it wasn't at least a 7, it just had to sort of like, we were like, we can't discuss this because we've got so many things to discuss. Mm. So like everything that was like a 7 and up got discussed. And it would be like, we'd sort of just talk through the ideas, like basically like how unique was it, a perspective that this wasn't like an actual like fixed condition, but this is sort of what, how we ended up sort of sorting stuff out was like, so like how unique an idea is this for the, and like for the theme, is it really taking on board things for the theme, is it like sort of doing something that's kind of interesting? Something that Tab is like really good at doing, which I hadn't even thought about before, was like, what's the variety of the sex act like? Like, is it all going to be exactly the same sort of thing? Then that's not going to make for any interest in our body. So sort of like just sort of keeping an eye on all these different elements. And I think as a result, we got like a really sort of varied art style, but also like I think varied sort of story style. I think we've got some like really sweet sort of, I call them sweet, which feels like not quite the right word, but sort of ones that really make you go, that's really beautiful, like about like sort of long lost love, or like moving, like just sort of like these beautiful relationships. Or you've got stuff which is just kind of funny and a hoot, and then you've got like Nikki's story, which is just dirty and like it's just this great sort of combination of like, I don't know, everything you'd want to read in a erotic anthology.
As for like sifting through all that work, was there ever any desire or discussion of like, okay, we've got so much good here, like, do we need to make another anthology or repurpose some of these stories elsewhere?
I think Tab contacted a couple of favorites to put into the next anthology that's coming this fall, which is, it's actually a dual anthology for the same reason, Feast and Greed, which are polyamorous comics. So there's one all ages anthology and one erotic comic anthology, because he's like, there are not enough poly comics out there. Let's make two books.
That's so cool. Of
the comics that we got submitted to Succulent that he thought fit really well, he finally contacted them to be for that.
Yeah, I was specifically wondering about that with the wide variety of like representation we've seen in these anthologies so far, if we would get a polyamorous one at some point in the future.
Oh, yes.
And that's really exciting to hear. Maybe Tab will have to come on the show to talk about that one come this fall.
Yeah, there are some poly comics in Succulent as well.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Before I bring this to the final question of the week, I did at least want to ask if there's any final thoughts around Succulent you wanted to share as far as bumping up the Kickstarter or your experience with that so far.
We are just about 69%, which is amazing. It is exactly 1 week since we launched. it is been going really, really well. And it's been really great to see the reaction.
Yeah, it's been a really good opening day. And then like, it's just continued to fund really steadily since then. And I think we've had a great reaction because it is like a great book. And like the creative teams that are like really strong. And yeah, I think it's a great book. And I feel like sapphics always be thirsty, and there's never enough thirsty sapphic content to ever whet the appetite. Like,
yeah, sometimes you get a little typecast as like pure. And we are, this book is not pure.
Mm-hmm.
It's really dirty and really fun.
Yeah. Now, on that thought then, for today's wild card final question of the week, I've got to ask, what plant is sexiest?
No idea.
Like a Georgia O'Keeffe pomegranate. I mean, I don't spend my life thinking about cactuses, but the moment we sort of launched upon succulent as the idea, I was just like, it's gotta be a cactus. Like, you've just got it. Someone's gotta fuck a cactus in this book, and I will be the person to do it. I'm brave. And I don't know why that sort of came to me, but I think it's the danger.
The danger of it.
Yeah, that is really hard.
I'll accept like fruits, vegetables, any kind of vegetation if it helps, Nikki.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go with that Yuri classic, right? The lily.
Mm.
Bring it back.
Very anime, very nice. But as we wrap up, I really just wanted to thank you so much for reaching out to me and taking the time to come on the show. I had a great time researching your work and really feel like it helped expand my comic horizons in the process. And so for our listeners at home that would like to do the same, where can they find you both and your work online?
I'm Nikki, Nikki-Smith.com, and then Nikki Smith Comics on most social media at this point.
I'm at Dr. Ollie Hicks on Instagram and Twitter, and I think also Blue Sky. And I'm Ollie Hicks Comics on Etsy if you want to get my self-published stuff.
All right. Well, if the listeners at home have requests or recommendations for comics or creators you'd like us to cover in the future, you can send them our way on social media. You can find us on the Transcending Comics Instagram and Facebook page, on Twitter is at Transcend Comics, or email us at transcendingcomics@gmail.com. I'd like to thank you for giving our podcast a chance and give a special shout out to Ray Day Parade for designing our logo. Our intro and outro music this week is A Little Soul and You've Been Starring by Carlson. You can check out more of his music on carlson.com. Join us again next time as we continue transcending boundaries and exploring the colorful world of trans, non-binary, and genderqueer representation in comic books of all kinds. As the curtains fall on this episode of Transcending Comics, remember that comics have the power to inspire change in countless worlds, including our own. Keep reading, keep writing, and keep transcending.